A couple of points you mentioned that I'd like to try to clarify. You mentioned that it, I thought it was around 2005, you said, and correct me if I've gotten you wrong, Goldman decided that it needed more super senior protection because you wanted essentially a more fully sold capital structure. Is that correct? Is that a misstatement?
I believe what I said is that in May of 2005, we were directed to complete capital structure for a number of Abacus transactions to mitigate our correlation risk.
And was that just past transactions or transactions going forward as well?
A few past transactions, as well as that directive also applied to ongoing transactions. So transactions subsequent to May 2005.
And so how did that change the process of executing transactions?
It didn't really.
So you could proceed with the transaction without having super senior protection sold?
The way that this was monitored was that we would receive permission to proceed with a transaction from the relevant capital committee. We would also be expected, you know, within the transaction, there was an expectation that we would be substantially completing capital structure, and this was a point that I would call mortgage department management would monitor, you know, subsequent to the transaction, to make sure that in fact the super senior was being adequately covered, and we would periodically prepare risk reports that would show this.
And did you generally have the super senior lined up prior to closing?
It varied as to the date.
When I say prior to closing, I also include within a week or two after closing.
No, even of the notes you're referring to?
Yes.
In some cases, super senior preceded the notes. In some cases, it was after.
After by a week or two, or after by 2 months, 6 months, 2 years?
With the exception of those first trades in May that we talked about, where there was a significant lag between the note trade and the super senior, I don't recall that it was ever more than it was not in the years that I recall. It would be in some proximity to the
so maybe
to the
within
notes.
A month.
Well, I don't know if it was literally always a month, but it was not a year, I don't recall.
So the objective was that it would be very close to that date?
I think the way I described it previously was most accurate was that we were attempting to complete capital structure on the majority of transactions that we were doing. And not all of them, but a significant fraction. And this was an aspect of the book that was being monitored in terms of risk management.
So would you say that in 80 or more percent of the transactions you had approached a super senior prior to the closing of the notes?
And when you say percentage, you're referring to the number of transactions or some notional amount?
No, the number, I'm just trying to say, even if there were exceptions, in the substantial majority of transactions, had you initiated conversations with the super senior prior to the close?
I'm sorry, I heard the question. You're saying specifically prior to the close or in proximity?
In this case, I'm saying prior to the closing.
Yeah, I just don't know, I recall all the transactions well enough to remember that degree of date precision.
So it was not true that someone would you would know of some more mezzanine interest, and you would not. I probably shouldn't ask questions in the negative. It shows that I'm not the investigative attorney. So let me start again. I guess when you had identified some long interest, how long after, what period of time after that would it normally be before you initiated discussions on finding an outlet for the super scene?
Well, with respect to the trades that I have, you know, more personal recollection of, that I was more personally involved in, I understood your question to refer to when would we approach people, which I would distinguish from when the transaction actually happened, since different participants had different transaction review and approval times. So are you asking me when we approach people or when we actually transacted with people?
No, I meant approached. I understand that these are discussions and negotiations, so... Yeah.
I mean, with the exception of these first super senior trades in May of 05, you know, which did happen with some lag to the notes, subsequent to May 2005, Sorry, what was the time period you had in mind?
Prior to May 2005. I'm just trying to understand the general process of the creation of these transactions and the sequencing of various activities as part of putting the transaction together.
Okay. I think I can address the question as you phrased that way. For the bespoke transactions, it was customary, as I recall, to complete the bespoke transaction before approaching the super senior, a potential super senior provider, since we wouldn't necessarily know what the transaction was yet. For certain other transactions that were more broadly syndicated, I recall we would approach super senior providers in and around the same time period that the notes were being shown to market participants generally.
And aside from infamous AIG, who else were the super senior counterparties that you recall?
In no particular order, I recall that Morgan Stanley, the crop desk at Morgan Stanley, was a significant super senior protection buyer, provider, I should say. I recall that MBIA was for various CMBS-related transactions, although we typically had intermediation, where you know Goldman would have there would be a commercial bank that would stand between the monoline and Goldman.
So they were negative basis trades.
No, they were monoline intermediation trades.
Okay.
Distinct.
Okay.
ACA, the monoline group, was another party. Again, similar to MBIA, there would be an intermediation Those are the ones I recall off the top of my head.
And was AIG the largest part of the super senior advocacy program?
I'd have to add up the numbers. I believe that MBIA may have been comparable or maybe even slightly larger, but I just have to check the numbers. And Morgan Stanley Morgan Stanley, I believe, as I recall, was probably in, smaller, but probably not much smaller. So I'd say probably a significant fraction of the same size.
What sort of marketing work did you or colleagues do to find long interest for the Abacus program?
You refer to marketing in a particular transaction, or
no? To find long interest. So whether it was a particular transaction or to find what I don't want to get into definitional debates about what was reverse inquiry or not. So, to generate interest.
Well, I mean, we received a lot of interest, and the market was quite robust. So we would have, numerous conversations that salespeople would arrange with customers that wished to understand, what the investment opportunities were. And some of those conversations were, didn't result in a transaction being considered. Some of it may have been informational for the customer. I don't know. And some did become, evolve into transactions.
My original question is, what marketing activities were you or colleagues involved in to find long interest?
Can you maybe put some context on what you mean by marketing activities?
Something beyond getting on the phone when a salesman called you.
Okay. So you're talking more face-to-face meetings?
No, not necessarily. For example, some of the things we've seen in the documents, there's term sheets, there's flip books, and when an abacus deal is getting put together, is there a distribution list to send out the term sheets to send out the flip books to? Is there a code calling operation to find long interest? Just generally what's done to sell the deal.
Okay. Well, I guess maybe I misunderstood the question.
You may answer this question.
Okay. So my recollection with respect to the documents you described was for syndicated transactions, the syndicate would communicate those marketing documents to salespeople. Somebody in our team who was, kind of responsible for moving the ball along on that document would, when it was ready, provide it to the syndicate desk, who would then distribute it with the correct disclaimers, etc., to salespeople. So, there may have been subsequent follow-up conversations if a customer called in and said, well, I have a question on this. So I don't know if that was in the scope of the question, as a result of those being sent out. So for bespoke transactions, my recollection was that there was not typically flip books because they were bilateral.
And would that be, like, for example, on a bespoke transaction, and let's just go back to the first one we were talking about, you know, with IKB, they want to do that transaction, and that's done. So another part of that isn't, okay, IKB's approached us, we're going to put together Abacus 2004-1, put together a term sheet, let's put together a flip book and see if there's other investors that are interested.
I don't recall there was a flip book for that 2004.
And in general, just not just in the 2004 one, but for any bespoke negotiated transaction.
I don't recall that there were flip books for you know the IKB bespoke transactions. My recollections were typically term sheets. That term sheets could be used to have a conversation with the customer about what the deal, you know, the real key terms of the deal.
Were there flip books for the Abacus program in general?
I don't recall that there was like one specific Abacus program flip book that was made available to customers, no.
Did you have, whether it was one specific one or a variety of them, did you have flip books that explained the Abacus program?
I recall going to, you know, certain investor meetings. For instance, if I was traveling on a plane to London or Asia to meet customers, I would typically bring a few pages to explain some of the transactions we were doing. I don't know if that's in your scope.
Did you have a marketing effort to explain the Abacus program and attract new long interest?
A marketing program? No, I would say we just talked to customers who were in the CDO business.
You didn't talk to customers who hadn't done CDO trades before?
No, I can't say with 100% precision that every customer that I had spoken with had done a CDO trade before, because I wasn't familiar with their activities. But the customers that... I think I want to make sure that I'm answering your question, because I talked to a lot of customers that had nothing to do with Abacus transactions, right? Because we were making markets in products like Tabex, which were unrelated to Abacus, right? That's a standard tranche credit default swap. So I don't know if those customers, who might have been hedge funds, you know, were ever interested in buying or selling CDOs. Okay, so I spoke with macro hedge funds who were probably more interested just in having, you know, discussion about the economy or the mortgage market. So I can't say that those customers had bought CDOs.
I'd like to switch gears a little. Could you, since there is not publicly available information on this, could you speak to the extent you know on the relative size of the single name pay-as-you-go swap market versus ABX market versus CDO market?
I haven't seen any definitive information on those topics, the sizes.
Do you have any feel for it anyway?
I really don't have any basis to guess.
Okay. Were you involved? Was your desk, the primary desk, involved in the single name pay-as-you-go swap?
No.
And which desk would that be?
For RMBS or for
yes.
Other products? I was distinguishing from CMBS or other that also had. My recollection is we had a specific market making desk in the mortgage department that traded single name default swaps on RMBS.
Sure, and you meant another thing that we don't have very much information on is the size of the synthetic CDO market and kind of where was your sense of where you fit in as far as volume issuance of synthetic CDOs? Where did Goldman kind of fit in?
Well, synthetic CDOs included, other than Abacus included.
Right.
The full waterfall type,
right,
capital structure type CDOs. So, are you asking for
a bleed table type? I don't need an exact number, just kind of where you felt you were in the space. Yeah.
I don't really know. I mean, I don't recall seeing league tables specifically for Abacus-style synthetic CDOs. I do recall seeing league tables for total CDOs.
Right. That's what. Okay. Who else was active in this space outside of Goldman? What other Wall Street firms were active in the? Because you said you found out that Morgan Stanley or Deutsche Bank was doing similar trades. Who else was kind of heavily involved in the space?
Sure. You're referring to bespoke type, like Abacus style CDOs, or synthetics generally?
Bespoke type.
I'll repeat some of the names I mentioned earlier, but I'll try to be more comprehensive. So, Morgan Stanley did transactions referred to as AB spoke and CMB spoke.
Okay.
That had some similarities. Morgan Stanley also did transactions referred to as Baldwin that were structured in a similar, in many respects, a partial capital structure style transaction. Deutsche Bank did transactions referred to as Syrah and Ixion that we were aware of. Credit Suisse did transactions under the name Magnolia. Merrill Lynch did transactions referred to, they did a transaction referred to as Steers, and they also did transactions referred to as Calculus, that I recall. I mentioned BNP Paribas did some trades they referred to as Mermaid. Calion did some trades referred to as, I believe it was Absolute. SocGen did some trades referred to as Sonoma Valley. UBS did trades referred to as North Street. AIG Financial Products did a trade referred to as Horizon. That trade actually was done in May of 2004, so it actually preceded the Abacus transactions. And that was where AIG was the protection buyer under the swap. See if I've left out any others. Morgan Stanley did a trade referred to as Ballista. Lehman Brothers did I don't remember the name of the trade Lehman Brothers did. Bear Stearns did a trade referred to as Millbrook. Those are the ones I recall.
All right, and this kind of asks this question of a couple people. This is the last one, but you read that a lot of people are of the opinion that synthetic CDOs don't add anything to the economy. What's your kind of view on the pros or cons of synthetic CDOs?
Well. You're looking for my opinion,
right? Yeah, so just your opinion.
So I can't, you know, speak for the economy.
Right. No.
Okay. This is, I'll try to answer this in a helpful way. If I can. This is a hard question. The synthetic CDOs filled, you know, a need for a certain class of investors that wish to take credit exposure to debt instruments, whether it was mortgages, corporates, sovereigns, other types of debt instruments that could be referenced in various CDOs. And these institutions needed to, you know, could not, to my recollection, directly invest in the underlying instrument for reasons relating to the structure of the instrument or, you know, their inability to assemble the portfolios that they wanted to invest in. So I think that synthetic CDOs did act to increase the amount of the debt capacity or credit capacity to these sectors of the economy. Now we can look back in hindsight and say, well, was it too much credit? That's for others with more expertise, I guess, to say. But synthetic CDOs, I do believe, acted to increase and broaden the universe of investors who were able to express a bullish view on the U.S. mortgage market in the specific case here. And I think that did act to both increase the volume of credit and lower the cost of credit to homeowners in the United States. Again, others can judge whether that was, in retrospect, too much credit at too good a price.
So to be take devil's advocate on that, since synthetic CDOs were synthetic instruments, how does that translate into more cash mortgages to homeowners?
A great question, and I'll try to make it not sound complex, because actually it's not as complex, but I'm just not good at explaining things. So, well, first I'm going to put on the side the fact that these synthetic CDOs did actually purchase cash investments for the collateral securities, right? So, well, I'm going to put that as, I think that's the simpler thing to understand.
You mean in hybrids?
Not in hybrids, in Abacus transactions, the $5.5 billion approximate Abacus transactions that were issued in note form.
So you're referring to the AAA
correct.
Collateral.
That purchased, to the extent we purchased, which we did,
fine.
RMBS, Alt A, subprime, that was in fact a direct investment
fine.
Of that vehicle, which was indirectly caused by the synthetic CDO issuance.
Fine.
So putting that first order investment in credit, mortgage credit aside, the synthetic protection purchased from these vehicles permitted, you know, based on my experience, institutions such as Goldman or customers that wish to use this protection as a hedge to more comfortably extend mortgage credit. So I think it's part of a prudent business of risk management, the ability to source protection allowed a number of business, you know, market participants to run their business more efficiently.
And here, are you speaking mortgage originators? Are you speaking of broker dealers? Are you doing the securitizing?
I'm referring to both. Again, I don't have direct knowledge of how much specific originators hedged, although I am aware that originators did, in fact, at least some did, in fact, use synthetic technology to hedge. Others, I guess, didn't. But I do think that's part of prudent risk management, and I think overall contributed to an increase in the capacity for the securitization market writ large in toto to function.
Okay. Just do you have? I don't want to get lost from the question and wandering around. Are there any other ways that you would say synthetic CDOs contributed to more cash subprime? Or is it just that it was the ability to hedge? If there was something else you wanted to add to that answer, I wanted to elicit.
Well, no, those are the two things that I can think of.
That actually leads into some of these bigger picture questions that are on my list. And the first one was, do you think that the synthetic developments of whether it's synthetic CDOs or pay-as-you-go swaps or ABX help keep the housing bubble going?
I'm sorry, you listed ABX, synthetic CDOs, and credit default swaps, generally?
Yes.
Kept the housing bubble going. You know, I don't know.
This is pure opinion.
I wasn't a subprime originator or a mortgage originator, and I didn't really interact with that side of the business other than to discuss, you know, how they might want to hedge. So I don't really know, you know, what extent it kept the bubble going.
One of the arguments is that CDOs was the outlet, mezzanine CDOs were the outlet for BBB subprime paper, became big demand for that paper, and so it allowed faster, lower cost origination of the rest of the subprime capital structure.
So you're referring to cash CDOs that purchased subprime cash bonds?
Yes, and hybrid.
Well, I do agree with the statement that my understanding was that CDOs did purchase mezzanine RMBS. You know, as to what fraction of the total they bought, I haven't seen data on that.
How did you see the market change, the CDO market, the synthetics market change with the introduction of ABX?
ABX. The ABX, how did the CDO market, I don't know that I perceived
or correlation trading market.
Right, well, ABX was not specifically a correlation trading product. It was just a basket of subprime, right, that were already issued.
Change the question to TabX?
TabX. Yeah, would you like me to answer the ABX one or the TabX one? Or both?
Or both.
Or, yeah. I won't say neither. First, with respect to ABX, I don't recall a perceptible change in the CDO market with respect to the introduction of ABX. With respect to TabX, I did perceive a change, which was twofold. First, that certain portions of the capital structure in CDOs experienced a repricing because TabX was a competing product, and customers could take exposure to subprime-related credit in one form or the other. Either they could purchase CDOs or they could purchase TabX. So So in fact, you know, my understanding was, although we didn't actually sell notes linked to TabX, my understanding was that the number of transactions did happen. I'm talking about off my desk. And therefore, you know, just competitive markets, that the market experienced some repricing as a result of that.
Do you have a sense that trading volumes increased very substantially because either ABX or TabX were introduced?
On ABX, I don't have information on trading volumes. I wasn't responsible for trading that product.
I don't mean just in those instruments, but I meant more broadly in these markets.
Yeah, I wouldn't know for ABX. For TabX, the TabX trading was done on my desk. You were essentially comparing to something that didn't really exist before, so I don't know what the metric is for the increase, but you know, we did see customer interest, both long and short, in trading that product.
And did overall trading volumes seem to increase at those time periods?
I would say I don't recall observing a change in the trading of the other products that already existed, but we certainly saw incremental trading pertaining to the TabX product.
Shifting gears, the puts that you had in the Abacus program, those were continued to be somehow on your trading book?
That's correct.
Do you happen to know if that was common practice at your competitors?
I know that, for having looked at the documentation for some competitors' deals, that became aware of that some other competitors had structures like that. I also observed that some other competitors used a different structure, where in particular the other common structure was a guaranteed investment contract provided by an insurer such as AMBAC, and so the customer in that case would be taking the AMBAC risk.
I think my question more relates to, were you aware of others in the marketplace that would have used this mechanism to place to find an outlet for hard to place collateral? Moving it off its books.
Well, I would disagree with two premises of the question. If I may, first, I wouldn't describe the collateral as being hard to place with respect to these securities, nor would I describe it as moving off our books, since in fact we retained the put, which was a traded instrument on our books.
Just for clarity, I was acknowledging that it was on your trading book, so I was speaking only of others in the marketplace.
Others.
So I was asking you about others.
Okay, I'm sorry, I misheard that then.
This may help. There is a lawsuit out there against Merrill Lynch by an entity called Rabobank. That one of the allegations in that complaint is you took the cash investment from the long investors and you purchased your stuff at par when it was worth about 80 cents on the dollar. Don't hold me to the actual numbers, but that's the general allegation. And so I guess the question is, have you heard about that kind of activity out there on the street in your competitors where that's going on and there's not one of these par puts, you know, built into the deal?
I haven't heard. I mean, we've had a lot of framework. I've heard, chatter about these types of complaints. I don't know that I have any knowledge about the merits of them. And I'm not familiar of a specific circumstance where you know, based on what I've seen in terms of actual transaction documents, where there wasn't a par put or some analogous instrument like a total return swap. So I'm not familiar with a transaction structure that was what you described.
Again, going back to the shift in 2005 when you were supposed to more fully place the capital structure, did that change what you were doing with subordinate pieces?
Oh, sorry, was your question prior to 2005 or after 2005?
After 2005.
No, I didn't recall there being a change.
So, did I misunderstand the policy shift? Was the policy shift only that you needed to find additional super senior, or was it that you also had to find outlets for the full capital, for any parts of the capital structure that are not in place?
I agree with the latter way you phrased it. The way we understood the risk management instructions was that we should seek to not have substantial uncovered correlation risk. So that would include super senior. It also would include, in some cases, purchasing protection on junior layers of the transaction. Some of those are listed here. Although we would not be required for the first loss to purchase 100% of the first loss, but there was also an effort, as I described earlier, it was not just the notional amount, but also just knowing what the price was. That you know, having a sense that the market values were adequately captured in our risk systems. So we were not required to cover 100% of every tranche, but we were required to seek to do trades on every tranche to identify the price of those tranches. And in many cases, you know, we did super senior trades, as we discussed earlier.
I had missed that distinction. Was the super senior to provide real coverage for the exposure, or just to test the proper pricing?
No, to cover the exposure, predominantly in the case of the super senior. As I was trying to describe, the super senior tranche by construction was a large notional amount.
Right.
So, we did not cover the super senior risk in every transaction. My recollection was that my supervisors would look at the aggregate amount of super senior exposure and look at it in that regard.
So the volume, because it was so great, outweighed it's a bit counterintuitive that there would be great concern about finding an outlet for the super senior, you know, least risky tranches versus the first loss.
Well, that's a very interesting way of putting it. I think that you've also, in some sense, if I may, maybe intentionally or not, characterized one of the problems, if you will, that I think many people didn't appreciate. That there was risk in the super senior layer, that models are fallible. And as I mentioned earlier, our instructions to cover super senior risk arose because of what we and others observed in the corporate dislocation relating to the downgrade of GM and Ford. So that was a lesson available to everyone.
So it's a view of the potential risk of correlation changing
in these instruments.
I would agree with that characterization, yes.
Gentlemen?
I just have a couple of things. Take a look at this document. Just give it a quick scan. You got this.
Hey, Jonathan, can you tell me what exhibit number?
It's 114.
114.
Which is circa February 07.
Yes, I scanned the document.
Okay. I'm just curious, in the middle of the document, it's actually a string, as you know, of emails. There's one from... Well, at the bottom, which is presumably the first in time, there's a discussion of Mr. Paulson's role vis-a-vis AC, Abacus 2007 AC1. And the question on the table appears to be whether or not the deal should go to the Mortgage Capital Committee for approval.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Rosenblum appears to say yes because of reputational risk associated with, I presume, the Paulson involvement and the nature of that involvement. Do you recollect reputational risk being discussed in the context of Mr. Paulson's role in AC1?
I wouldn't agree with your premise of the characterization of this email, but I actually recall this email quite well. Mr. Tor sent this email to Mr. Sparks and a number of other people, including, certain desk supervisors that are listed here, and my understanding of the AC1 transaction, based on what communicated to me at the time, was that of course we were going to go to Mortgage Capital Committee because mm-hmm. that was what we did with respect to underwritings. To discuss in the memo the things to be considered, which included reputational risk, potential conflicts of interest, transactional risk, such as just the risk management, etc. And so I recall this email quite well because I remember saying to Mr. Tor, I believe it was even before this response was received, which was, it looks like it was early in the morning, following day, that I recall saying to Mr. Tor, yes, of course we're going to go to Mortgage Capital Committee. I don't see why, that's fine to post people, but I didn't understand why there was a need to ask whether we should go. So I don't think, Mr. Rosenblum, I don't recall, sat in proximity to us, and he was more involved in the CLO business, so I don't know that he had any real understanding of the specifics of the transaction. I don't know why he would, because he was not really involved. And so I interpreted this response at the time mm-hmm. as not saying that Mr. Rosenblum, having knowledge of the specifics here, suggesting, well, there's a reputational issue, so you should go on this specific trade. I understood this at the time as Mr. Rosenblum simply referring to more of just an understanding of policy that for underwritings, one goes to Mortgage Capital Committee. That's how I interpret this transaction, okay. This email at the time.
Help me understand that, because the Mr. Rosenblum is calling out reputational risk, quote unquote. He's not talking about underwriting risk, unless I'm misreading that document.
I believe you are
from reputational risk to underwriting risk.
If I may,
I want to understand it. What happened? Yeah, okay.
If we look at the detailed text, and again, I didn't speak with Mr. Tor prior to him sending this email, but I do recall speaking with him after I read the email. If I can focus here on the second half of this, he says, at the time we distribute, we will cross the tranches into Paulson, therefore no commitment to take down any risk. Do you need us to go, and I'm skipping that sentence, happy to sit down to walk through the economics, do you need us to go to Mortgage Capital Committee for this trade? So as I read that literally, again, not having spoken to Mr. Tornavance, it seems to me that Mr. Tor is pointing out that the feature of the transaction that he's pointing out is there's not going to be any risk of Goldman Sachs losing money on this trade because there's nothing required that Goldman is actually doing a firm underwriting of any security. There's no risk that securities will have to be purchased, which they may have to be resold at a loss. So he's, as I read it, he's pointing out, saying, no commitment, take any risk. So given this a riskless transaction, do you think we need to go to commitment? Again, my understanding mm-hmm. of policies was that Mortgage Capital Limited did care about risks other than trading risk, for instance, reputational risk, conflicts of interest. They also, my recollection was, would typically talk to a group within Goldman that would often do background checks on parties related to underwritings, et cetera. Those sorts of more generally mm-hmm. speaking, reputational risks. So my understanding was that Mr. Rosenblum was referring to those other risks other than just the trading risk. Not, I didn't interpret him as saying that the specific that Paulson was involved in this trade was what flagged his attention.
So the Paulson from your, the Paulson reference and potentially his interesting role here is irrelevant to it. It's the fact that Goldman was not taking on any risk is the point that triggered the reputational risk.
I don't want to speak for Mr. Rosenblum. My interpretation of this was that, again, I'm mm-hmm. giving my view, was that he, as a manager in the department, but who's not intimately associated with the transaction, was expressing a view which I concurred with, that for underwriting transactions, even if they did not involve us taking market risk, we went to committee to vet those issues.
Okay. Which segues nicely to the next question, which is, were you aware or did you participate in any discussions, either verbally or via email, within Goldman on the question of potential reputational risk vis-a-vis Mr. Paulson's role in AC1?
I don't recall any discussions about that.
Did you attend the MCC meeting at which AC1 was discussed?
I don't recall.
Okay.
I don't recall.
All right.
We weren't necessarily required to attend also. I just don't recall.
Okay. Thank you. That's it?
When there were credit-linked notes, did Goldman generally intermediate between the note buyer and the CDO?
No. I would actually describe it more as the CDO intermediating between the note buyer and Goldman.
Goldman on the short side.
Goldman is a protection buyer, and the note investor indirectly
right.
the protection seller.
Right.
Mr. Eagle, thank you very much for your
time. Thank you. You're very welcome.
Thank you.